From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are now exactly 1 week from Election Day. And the FBI is in the process of reviewing emails recently found on a computer belonging to Anthony Weiner, the estranged husband of Hillary Clinton aide Huma Abedin, to see if they're relevant to Clinton's use of a private server while Secretary of State. It is unclear at this point whether that review will be done before the election. Meanwhile, new stories are cropping up about Donald Trump and his possible links to Russia and about his taxes. For more now, Rick Klein joins us. He's political director at ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
Well, first of all, the email review, how likely is it that anything new and concrete is going to come out before Election Day?
We're hearing conflicting things. On one level, we're told there's just so much volume and such a reticence to be involved in the politics that we're unlikely to hear something concrete before Election Day. On the other hand, the pressure on the FBI director right now is immense, and he is going through an expedited review process. He's ordered that up, and I think they'll be playing it out day by day. Oddly to me, the Clinton camp, which has been calling for more information, they may end up regretting that because that at least keeps the story in the headlines. I think they'd better off just watching this fade away.
Well, some of the pressure on the FBI director is coming from the Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, who wrote a letter and accused Comey and the FBI of having and sitting on, quote, explosive information about close ties and coordination between Donald Trump, his top advisors, and the Russian government. Is there anything to that?
Well, on one level, this is what Harry Reid does. He throws out unfounded things before an election. But this is an actual concrete investigation that has been buzzed about for months and months, and members of Congress have been briefed on it. Now, Harry Reid lifting the veil across that. The New York Times reporting that, that there were no links that were found. We've been looking as well to see if there's any advancement in the investigation. It does seem like there are several strands of an investigation. There's potential business links between Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign chairman, and Russian business interests, which, some of which are documented. There's also reporting out there about computer connections between Trump Tower and Russian interests, but nothing that's been nailed down. And I think the FBI has been reticent to confirm or deny or to get involved in the Russia angle of this because they just haven't found anything that, that a case can be made on. The Clinton camp, of course, has an interest in muddying the water and making this as much of a story going up to Election Day. I think the story of Russian interference is a big one, but in terms of the hacking, but I don't know that anyone's been able to make that direct link to the Trump campaign.
There is also more reporting coming out about Trump and his taxes. There's new reporting out last night that says that Trump used a legally questionable move to avoid reporting hundreds of millions of dollars in taxable income in the early 1990s. Tell us more about what we're learning there.
Well, first, it should be noted that it doesn't appear to have been illegal at the time. It's since been outlawed. It has to do with how you report losses that the particularly other individuals have gone through. According to the Times, he was advised that this would spark an audit. In the interest of IRS investigators, we asked one of his top campaign officials just this morning about it, and they say that there's no more daylight that they can shed on it because he's not going to be releasing his taxes until it's out from under audit. I think this highlights two things. One is Trump misplayed this by not putting his taxes out a year ago. I think if he had done it, it would have been a story then and whatever fallout you have. And second, we're not going to see his taxes. And that is going to be unprecedented over the last four decades of presidential politics. Voters are free to make the judgments they want on that. And I think that any individual pieces of information out there are unlikely to change many voters' minds. I think that piece of it is based in the cake.
Where do you think we are in the campaign right now? Just a week to go and a lot of early voting already done.
There's a definite tightening, no doubt about that. We've seen it in our ABC News tracking poll, which actually has Trump up by 1 point for the first time against Hillary Clinton since May. I, though, don't read too much into that. I think a lot of that would have naturally happened anyway. It's the base coming home. I think you're going to have day-to-day fluctuations in the national numbers. I still think, talking to strategists on both sides, that this is an electoral map that heavily favors Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump needs all of these states practically to tip his way all at the same time. We haven't seen signs of that in the polling. And I'll tell you, even talking to these strategists, they don't feel like this story that dropped this bombshell from the FBI on Friday moved things very much. Maybe a point or two here or there in terms of turnout, but Hillary Clinton had a bigger margin than that. She does have advantages in early voting. So I think the map shifts slightly, but I still think we go into this final week advantage Hillary.
That's Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Rick, thanks as always.
Hey, thank you so much.
Well, today, without mentioning Donald Trump by name, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan told Fox News that he did cast his ballot for the GOP nominee in early voting while supporting his party's entire ticket. In the past few months, Ryan has vowed not to campaign for or defend Donald Trump in a very public feud that's put Ryan's position as House Speaker in question. Marty Michelson from Here and Now contributor WUWM in Milwaukee reports.
It felt pretty uncomfortable when House Speaker Paul Ryan took the stage at a campaign rally in Elkhorn, Wisconsin last month. Ryan was there to introduce Donald Trump to a couple of hundred Trump supporters. Thing is, Ryan knew Trump was not showing up.
Let me just start off by saying there is a bit of an elephant in the room. And it is a troubling situation. I'm serious. It is. I put out a statement about
Ryan acknowledged Trump's absence from the rally, but didn't mention him by name. And as he concluded his speech, Trump supporters chanted, "Shame on you."
Thank you for coming out for Fall Fest, everybody. Thank you so much, you guys. God bless you all. Thank you. Appreciate it.
The rally goers were angry with Ryan. The night before, he had issued a statement saying Trump's lewd comments about women in the Access Hollywood video sickened him. Later, Ryan said he would not defend Trump, nor would he campaign with him. Trump tweeted that it's hard to do well without backing from the party and criticized Ryan in an interview with Fox News.
I think we should get support, and we don't get the support from guys like Paul Ryan. He had a conference call yesterday with congressmen, with hundreds of them, and they practically rioted against him on the phone. One person stuck up for him. So I'm just tired of non-support, and I don't really want to support.
I'm not a Paul Ryan fan. I haven't been for a long time.
Dan Ryan, no relation, is eating breakfast at Euros West in Waukesha, a Milwaukee suburb and Republican stronghold. He thinks Paul Ryan's actions will hurt Republicans in down-ballot races and amount to a victory for Democrats.
But I really don't think he wants Trump to be president. That's my gut feeling. I think he didn't want it from the get-go. He's an establishment. I truly believe that he would rather have Hillary be president than Trump. And I think that's been made very apparent. How do you go ahead?
But Trump supporter Bob Schaaf thinks the House Speaker is doing the best he can, striking a balance between denouncing Trump's comments while still endorsing his party's candidate for president.
Well, I like Paul Ryan, and I like the job he's doing for America and for Wisconsin, and he's entitled to his opinion.
However, a recent national poll from YouGov shows 64% of Trump voters have a negative view of Paul Ryan. One person hoping to capitalize on those numbers is Ryan Solon. The Democrat and Iraq war vet is challenging Paul Ryan for his seat in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District.
Hi, this is Dream from the Kenosha Democratic Party. Is this Frank?
Solon is mingling with volunteers, manning a phone bank at a field office in the district. While he's never held public office, Solon thinks he has a shot at knocking Paul Ryan off his roost. He claims his campaign is seeing donations from Republicans who want to see Ryan go.
Although some people do leave a note and say, you know, that they're Republicans, but I do get messages from some of the people that say they're supporting me as well. And so I can say that I'd say probably roughly an estimate, maybe a quarter to a third.
A Marquette University poll from September shows that 47% of Wisconsinites think Paul Ryan is doing a good job. But the speaker is taking nothing for granted. His campaign launched a TV ad last week promoting a post-election GOP agenda.
The Obamacare law is not working. We're going to replace that. We want our welfare system to be a system that gets people from welfare to work. We also are worried about our national security, making sure that our military has what they need. And that's precisely what we're going to be doing in the House. I'm Paul Ryan, and I approve this message.
It's highly unlikely that Ryan will lose his seat, according to Lily Gorin. She's a political scientist at Carroll University and says Ryan has won past contests in Wisconsin by overwhelming margins.
He is well-liked in the district for the most part, and I think that, you know, he will probably handily defeat his Democratic challenger.
But Paul Ryan's chances of becoming House Speaker again could be another story. Gorin says if Trump loses and Republicans, as expected, maintain control of the House, Trump's backers in the House may want payback.
Certainly members of the Freedom Caucus and to some degree some of the vocal supporters of Donald Trump would indicate that Paul Ryan has not been fully supportive of Trump's candidacy and that they may lay some blame on him for Donald Trump's loss in November.
If that happens, Ryan would likely find himself in a familiar position, mulling his options. He would have to decide if another stint as House Speaker is in order, or maybe going back to his role as House Ways and Means Committee Chair would be a better perch from which to assess the future of his party and his own political aspirations. House leadership elections are scheduled for mid-November. For Here and Now, I'm Marty Michelson in Milwaukee.
And there's a bizarre political scandal playing out in South Korea. At the center, the country's president, Park Geun-hye. Her longtime friend, who's also the daughter of a shadowy religious cult leader, has been arrested and accused of influence peddling and interfering in state affairs. The president apologized to the country for any security lapses with a humbling bow to television cameras, but her longtime friend Choi Soon-sil said she wanted to die, and then an angry construction worker said he wanted to help her do that, and he drove a front-end loader into the prosecutor's office. The BBC's Steve Evans joins us from Seoul, and Steve, start with, who is Choi Soon-sil?
She's been a friend of President Park for 40 years. And her father was a cult leader. He set up his own cult. He befriended the person who became president now, President Park, and so did his daughter 40 years ago. And since then, the two women, Ms. Che and President Park, have stayed in touch. And you think, well, what's wrong with two friends staying in touch and leaning on each other, relying on each other? But the suggestion is that this is a mysterious relationship. And the suggestion is that President Park, who's a powerful president, like the US president, would submit speeches, for example, and policy decisions to Ms. Che, and even ask her, what color should I wear on a particular day? So at the center is this strange, mysterious relationship. Nobody quite knows what the dynamic there is. But now Ms. Che faces the accusation that she's been using this friendship with the president to persuade companies to give substantial sums of money to funds she's set up. So that's the nub of the allegation. But really, it's about much more than that. It's about the color and the mystery of it all. Ms. Che, for example, has just been in Germany. She returned voluntarily with all these accusations swirling around. There was an amazing, huge scrum when she turned up at the prosecutors to be questioned. Maybe 200 reporters swirling around her like vultures around a carcass, you know, like an animal. And she lost a shoe in this scrum. It was a Prada shoe. Just another little bit of detail and drama.
Well, when she had an exchange with reporters in that scrum, she said she committed a sin that deserves death. As we said yesterday morning, a man said he wanted to help her die, and he drove this construction vehicle into the prosecutor's office. This is just sounding a little crazy. Also, we understand that prosecutors told reporters that she's an extremely unstable psychological state. Is that concerning people, that she is this close friend of the president and seems to be unhinged?
It is concerning, but it's not quite clear whether she meant it was a sin deserving of the death penalty or whether she simply meant, oh, I could die at the thought of it. Mm-hmm. So we don't want to make too much of that. But then bizarrely, at 8 o'clock this morning, a man turned up on his digger, construction digger. He brought it from 200 kilometres, 200 miles to the south of Seoul, driven the thing into the front of the prosecutor's office, and not just driven it through the glass, but then kind of moved it around and wiggled it around and had another go. There's a security guard is up on the digger trying to sort of spray his face with pepper spray or something like that. But this protester is absolutely determined. And then he gets out of the thing and says he did it because he's so angry at what's going on. What there is here, like in so many places, including the US, I suspect, and including my own Britain, is there is a great anger at the political class and the establishment or whatever. And that's focusing at the moment on this weird relationship between these two people.
Well, look, there are also serious issues. South Korea with its eye on North Korea there. Ms. Chair is also accused of, you know, having access to high-level documents despite having security clearance. Is there any concern that there's some real infractions here that could affect South Korea's security?
Well, I suppose if President Park ends up resigning, you then think, well, who's in charge of the country? But nobody, you know, there's a parliament. You know, I'm sure that if she did resign, she would be replaced, and one assumes the security would be kept tight. But, you know, we don't know. It's a very volatile situation.
Well, meanwhile, North Korea is jumping right into it joyfully, as the AP writes, calling South Korean's president the most deformed, abnormal, and stupid in contemporary society because of this scandal that has arisen. So we'll continue to follow this. The BBC's Steve Evans in Seoul. Steve, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, back at home, if you're a Facebook user, you may have noticed a surge in activity around North Dakota. That's where Native Americans from the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and their many supporters from across the country have been protesting construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. The protesters say it will endanger their water and sacred sites. The company says it's safer than trains or trucks for transporting oil. But now 900,000 people have used Facebook's location feature to check in to the Standing Rock Reservation in Fort Yates, North Dakota, to tag as if they're there when they're not, and they may be reacting to a false rumor. John Holt is a reporter for Argus Leader Media and USA Today Network. He joins us from his newsroom in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So, John, explain, how do people get this idea to tag themselves as in North Dakota when they're not?
Well, initially yesterday, the rumor was that the Morton County Sheriff's Department was using Facebook's check-in feature to track traffic to and from the camps to essentially target protesters. The Morton County Sheriff's Department released a statement yesterday saying that that is absolutely not the case. They aren't using the check-in feature. They don't want to use the check-in feature. It wouldn't be helpful for them. Protesters have said that law enforcement does monitor communications and comb social media for incriminating material, but it's not clear that they're actually using the check-in feature for any law enforcement purpose.
And we should say that Snopes.com, which debunks urban myths, has taken a look at this, I guess you'd call it a prairie myth, and said that it is just that, a myth, that they find no truth to it. But still, people are coming to the feature. What activity have you seen?
Well, yeah, a lot of people are still coming to the feature. And when I first started seeing this yesterday in my own Facebook feed, it was often accompanied by this sort of cut and paste explanation that Morton County Sheriff's Office was using this feature to track protesters. And about halfway through the day, that explanation was not quite as prominent. Mm. It sort of turned into people just checking in as a way to show solidarity with the protesters, to essentially say where they stand on the pipeline.
Right. And what are the people, you know, the protesters, it's a loose group of protesters, but what are they saying? Have they made any other public statements?
Yeah, it is very loose. There are several groups that are there. There's the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe officially. I got a statement from the Sacred Stone Camp that says, there's no solid line between organizers and others. It's a movement, not an organization. And when you talk to people up there, they talk like that. They say this is definitely a movement. And they say that this grew organically. No official sources, quote-unquote official sources, have taken credit for sort of starting this. Mm-hmm. But the organizers, or the protesters, whatever term you want to use, say they support the tactic. They appreciate the solidarity that's being expressed.
Right. But meanwhile, when the Morton County Sheriff's Department says it is not and does not follow Facebook check-ins for the protest camp or any location, this claim, rumor, is absolutely false. That's the statement from the spokesperson. Are they using Facebook at all?
Well, again, the people who are at the camp certainly believe that that social media is being used to comb for sort of incriminating material. I saw a tweet today that that sort of poked fun at Morton County by saying Morton County takes to Facebook to say that they're not using Facebook, because the statement was posted on Facebook. The statement saying we're not using Facebook was posted on Facebook. So there's certainly a belief that law enforcement is using Facebook. And to what degree it's being used, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, as you said, this went like wildfire through Facebook. But has there been a backlash, as there sometimes is, that this is slacktivism? You know, people, it's a slacker way of supporting a cause. It's not donating money. It's not showing up, as many are. Not everyone can travel there. But is there anyone saying, well, wait a second, this is, you know, you're really not doing anything by doing a location on Facebook?
Well, again, the people I have spoken to say they definitely support the tactic. It's great to express solidarity. But they also say, you know, if you can donate money to the Legal Defense Fund, and they want people to write their congresspeople. They want people to write the White House. They want some physical action. They want banks to divest, in the Dakota Access Pipeline. There are a lot of steps that they would like people to take, including going to the camps and writing people in power.
Yeah. Reporter John Hult of Argus Leader Media and USA Today Network. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Federal Reserve begins a two-day meeting in Washington today. It is widely expected to hold interest rates steady until after the election, which will be closely watched on Wall Street. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us from New York to talk about that and more in the business world. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And we're not expected to see a rate hike out of the Fed meeting today and tomorrow. Why is that?
No. Well, the main reason being that they typically, right before an election, don't want to change the interest rates because that can move markets and that can lead to suggestions that they were acting for political reasons. And typically it will move – if they're raising interest rates, it can move the market down. You've had Donald Trump accusing the central bank of keeping interest rates low ahead of the November election to help Democrats. Mrs. Yellen, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, she denies that. That said, you know, we may be seeing – their attitude change after the election.
And expecting a rate increase potentially in December.
That's right. Yeah, Fed officials, they've been signaling in recent weeks that a rate increase before the end of the year is likely. You've had Yellen saying that the case for another increase has increased in recent months. So before the end of the year, that's looking promising. I mean, right now, inflation is still low. The 2% benchmark that the Fed observes, they try to keep inflation below 2%. They're not at risk of hitting that. But at the same time, you know, there are a lot of savers out there who want to be able to get a little bit more for their money, get rewarded for saving their money.
So we got some news today that Gannett, the country's largest newspaper publisher, is abandoning its bid for Trunk, formerly Tribune Publishing, that publishes the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times. What's behind this?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been that friendly of an attempted merger all along. There are some pot shots taken by both companies' CEOs. Now, Trunk is saying that the deal fell apart when Gannett couldn't line up the financing. Meanwhile, a Gannett spokesman says that in the end, the terms were not acceptable. And I think there are a lot of shareholders in Trunk that were disappointed, and their shares fell by around 20% at one point. So, that deal collapsing for whatever the real reason was, not good. And it may also have to do with newspaper economics right now, something I know a little bit about working at the Journal.
Yeah, or perhaps the name Trunk, which we remember John Oliver made fun of, saying it sounds like a stack of print newspapers being thrown into a dumpster. So, Jason, one more story I have to ask you about today, and that is news that Sony reported its profits in the most recent quarter fell by 86%. What's going on there with Sony?
Well, Sony wants you to know it's not what it looks like. 88% sounds pretty bad. They say that it's because of the sale of its battery business that they're booking those losses. And they're also being hurt by the strong yen right now. That's hurting its profitability. They've been their sales of these sensors that they use in smartphones, they've had a reduction in profit of those because, again, of the stronger yen. And those sensors are an important component in many smartphones that are sold in Japan, made in Japan and largely sold overseas.
That's Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joining us with some thoughts on a few big business stories going on today. Jason, thanks as always.
Thank you.
As we come to the end of 8 years of the first black president in American history, we're reminded almost daily of the racism that still exists in this country. That shouldn't be a surprise, according to historian Edward Baptist. His book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism, is out in paperback today. I spoke with Edward Baptist in 2014, and I began with that title, The Half Has Never Been Told. I asked him if it referred to an acknowledgement that without slavery, America's economy never would have grown into the global dominant economy that it is today.
Yeah, I think that's one way to view the half. The other is to understand that a lot of that critique, that understanding of history was always there, in particular in the memories of formerly enslaved people.
So why do you think that that half has not been told?
Well, I think that by and large, the United States and more broadly Western societies have not wanted to hear that story over the last couple of centuries. We've lived through this period of increasing prosperity by and large, where we've had the fundamental transformation of our economies in a way that the world has never seen. And of course, there have been ups and downs, the Civil War, World War II, World War I, communism, etc. But over the course of that time, our world has been transformed by this sort of economic growth. And we don't want to hear that at its root, the economic growth depends to a large extent on slavery.
Well, make your case for us. Explain how important slavery was for the growth of the early American economy.
Well, both for the American economy and for the British economy, it's important to understand that the massive transformations that they go through in the 19th century, they shift from being primarily agricultural to primarily industrial in terms of how they make their wealth, how they generate their income. These processes happen first and foremost in cotton textile factories. And in order to have cotton textile factories, which are the first factories of the industrial system, and they change the way that people wear clothes all around the world, the way they buy clothes, the way that trade happens, the way that people work as they're now working in these factories instead of in the fields, none of that is possible without having cheap cotton. And cheap cotton, above all, is delivered to those factories by enslaved people in the expanding American South. In fact, they can deliver cotton so cheaply and to such a massive extent that they essentially put all other cotton producers out of business by the 1830s.
And you write in the book, cotton became the dominant driver of U.S. economic growth. In 1802, cotton already accounted for 14% of the value of all U.S. exports, but by 1820, it accounted for 42%.
Yeah, and that just continues to grow. In fact, from 1820 to 1860, over that long period of time, over half of all the money that's earned by U.S. products overseas comes from one single product, and that's cotton. You know, cotton plays a role that's kind of analogous in the world economy of the 19th century to what you see petroleum and petroleum products playing in our world today.
And you look at some of the detail that you bring up in this book, and particularly you're talking about New Orleans as the pivot of economic expansion. And you describe a New Orleans that looks very different from the New Orleans we see today, with just ship after ship after ship lined up there in New Orleans, ready to take export of all of this cotton.
That's right. It's the leading cotton port in the world. And it's also, by some measures in the 1830s, the most important financial center in the United States. Eventually, it'll lose that fight, and New York, of course, will become the financial center. But there's a moment where it looks like it can be. And there's one other thing that it's a crucial center for, and that's for the domestic slave trade. And that's the process of moving almost a million enslaved African Americans from the older states, where the chance for profits from field labor are not as good, but the chance for profits from selling people to the domestic slave traders are very good. So they get moved from those old states and are transported to the new states, where cotton planters in particular are ready to pay extremely high amounts of money in order to buy typically 16 to 25-year-olds, men and women.
And we know from history that there were people in this country who thought that slavery was abhorrent and thought that it should go away. But it looks, from what you're writing, that all along the way, those who really had the power of the federal government decided to allow it to happen because they knew how important it was to the economy of the U.S.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's a sense among some American policymakers around the time of the Constitution that slavery is doomed as an institution. We have to bargain with slaveholders right now who, after all, controlled a lot of the wealth of the country. But over time, as we can see, their profitability is decreasing. The planters of tobacco and rice and so on in particular are in hard times in the 1780s. As we see their profitability is decreasing, we can let slavery, in effect, die out on its own, especially if we close the slave trade from Africa. But because there was such a large population of enslaved people already, and because a new source of profit, the growing of cotton and the shipping of cotton to the new factory system, because that came up, it turned out that that calculation was completely wrong, in fact.
We're talking with Edward Baptist, author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. And Edward Baptist, we think of the people who were profiting from the slave trade as being in the South, at least the slave owners are having more direct tie to slavery. But in fact, you write, historians have been ignoring that investors from the North and from abroad benefited from slave labor cotton in the South. How did they benefit?
Yeah, I think this is something that historians are actually now starting to really catch hold of and run with. But it's a remarkable story. There, for instance, is a huge firm of slave traders, one of the biggest businesses in the United States by any measure in the years 1830 to 1832 or so. Isaac Franklin of Tennessee, John Armfield of Virginia, and Rice Ballard of Mississippi and Virginia. And these three individuals mastermind the moving of about 5,000 enslaved human beings a year from the older states to the new states. Now, this necessitates a huge amount of money and a huge amount of credit. And that means they have to have great relationships with banks. And they have great relationships with banks in Richmond and in Mississippi, and above all with the Bank of the United States, which is an officially chartered bank, the main depositor of the United States government at that time. It also serves as sort of the Federal Reserve as a regulator of the economy. And, oh, yeah, they're constantly lending money and getting paid back by these slave traders.
Would the slave trade have been able to grow to the size that it did without that amount of credit coming from these banks?
Probably not. That certainly makes the operations much more efficient. It makes slave buyers in places like Maryland or Virginia, it makes it much easier for them to pay a sort of uniform or standard predictable price. And then on the other hand, those close links to the banks in places like Mississippi enable them to help buyers line up loans from local banks and so on and so forth. Credit is crucial to the process.
So, Ed Baptist, what do you want ordinary Americans to take away from this book, the case that you're making that the life that we live today, the economy that we live in today, is based on an economy that started on slavery and we wouldn't be here today without it?
Yeah. When the United States achieves independence, it's fairly irrelevant on the world scene and certainly as a part of the global economy. It's pretty much small potatoes. By the time the Civil War starts in 1860, it's the second largest economy in the world, and it's the single biggest contributor to the success of the first economy in the world, which is Great Britain. And much of that growth, much of that transformation, much of that initial push, which we're still riding on today, you know, we've done other things since then, but I like to think of those years as those initial years of accumulation in the retirement portfolio, which are we know are so important if you want to build a big nest egg. So we know that much of that growth, much of that transformation comes from labor that was extracted from enslaved people and even financial wealth that was based on enslaved people's bodies, which were traded and commodified. And we know that that contribution was massively important. I think the first thing we need to do is to recognize that slavery isn't something that made a few people wealthy, but not other people. Or made a few people in the South wealthy, but not people in the North, or something that doesn't continue to have effects, not just on race relations or something like that, it clearly does that too, but on wealth and on power today. Slavery continues to have an impact on America in the most basic economic sense as well.
Ed Baptist, author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
What is it about pictures of animals? Here's one of a fox, face planted in a snowbank, back legs raised together as if in a graceful handstand. Then there's a prairie dog holding a single blade of grass and seeming to conduct an orchestra like the Geico gecko. But wait, does that black bear have wings? That rhinoceros, two heads. Just some of the 40 finalists in this year's Comedy Wildlife Photo Awards. The winners will be announced November 9th. The founder and wildlife photographer Paul Joynson Hicks joins us by Skype from Arusha, Tanzania. And Paul, where are you now? Because we're occasionally hearing crickets.
I'm in my house in the slopes of Mount Meru in Arusha, in Tanzania, surrounded by forest and monkeys and crickets.
And we're jealous. Well, talk about these pictures. They are just, what is it? Why do you think they evoke such a response?
I think the thing is that we see beautiful pictures of wildlife all the time. But I think when we see wildlife doing funny things where they, I think what they're doing is they're reflecting us as people, and they are looking hilarious. And whether it's them doing stupid things like, I mean, that fox, for example, which is a real favorite of mine. I mean, it's an amazing hunting technique of the Arctic fox. And we've seen it's the most extraordinary series of pictures. And I think when wildlife looks funny, we just love it.
So the fox, and we'll have all the pictures at herenow.org. The fox, what is he doing? That it's a hunting technique.
So what he does is he snuffles about, and then when he hears and smells, you know, a rodent running around under the snow, he jumps and dives in face first and grabs it with his teeth. And that's exactly what's caught by Angela, the photographer. It's really spectacular.
So not doing gymnastics. The two-headed rhinoceros is actually two rhinoceros. There's another one. Oh, my gosh. I think they're elk. I don't know if a rams. And it looks as if one is raising a leg to point to the other. Describe some of the ones that you are looking at.
When I'm looking through these 40 finest, see the mountain rams there, they're animals, but they look like they're doing a human thing. And then you've got when, for example, animals are mucking up, basically. Like, for example, the little elephant baby that's doing a face plant on the road. Young animals, they can often be malcoordinated, and this little one certainly was.
As you say, it's anthropomorphizing animals when we think that they're doing human things and they're not. But it does what? It kind of makes us feel better about ourselves?
I think because obviously as a species, as humans, we are, without a shadow of doubt, the worst species on the planet. You know, we know that. So you look at the wildlife world and you think they're all perfect. And actually, you know, they're not. They do fall over. They do miss things. Like, for example, I don't know if you can see the bear fishing at Katmai Falls, and he completely and utterly misses. He's got his wide open mouth, and there's a great big salmon hitting him on the side of the fence. And it is funny. And then you can see other pictures where the wildlife look like they're having fun. So you've got the leopards that with the amazing expression on their face, way, what's going on here? You've got the lions where one looks like it's having a complete laugh at a bad joke told by another one. You've got the tortoises. Well, you know, look at the tortoises. You know what they're doing. They certainly look like they're having fun.
There's a mouse that looks like he's walking on stilts.
Exactly. And he's just saying, hey, check me out. I'm on stilts.
Well, but there's a serious goal here the wildlife contest. What is that?
So through this competition, what we are trying to do is to raise a little bit of awareness about the problems that we have in the wildlife world. One elephant is killed every 20 minutes for its ivory. Wildlife areas are being hugely encroached by communities. You know, they're big issues. And, you know, when we're living in our big cities, we're perhaps not really aware of it. But what's happening is the wildlife world is being decimated at an unprecedented rate. And this is just my little effort at trying to make people aware of that, to try and stop it or slow it down at least, so that my children and my children's children can go out into wild areas and see wildlife.
Well, there is that. And then also you remind us, you are a wildlife photographer. This is very hard to do.
Exactly. So, I mean, a lot of these people are professional photographers who are out there day in, day out waiting for a great shot. promoting wildlife, which is also what we want to do.
So we'll post all the pictures. We'll let our listeners judge them as well. Last year's winner, just remind us.
So last year's winner was by an Austrian photographer called Julian Rad, and it was a wild European hamster. And it was a very spectacular photo, midair running, and its cheeks were full of hamster food, to be honest. I'm not entirely sure what hamsters eat in Austria. And it was brilliant.
Wildlife photographer Paul Joynson Hicks speaking to us from Arusha, Tanzania. He's founder of the Comedy Wildlife Awards. They'll be announced in early November. We'll be on top of that. Paul, thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for having me.
Jeremy, you've been looking a favorite.
I like the bear with wings who has an expression that seems to say, "Humph."
They're wings.
I'm on my way.
Yeah. You have a problem with that? Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.